Welcome to Cancer Out Loud, the Cancer Care Podcast, a show featuring conversations with people living with cancer, caregivers, survivors, loved ones, and the bereaved. Hosted by oncology social workers, Cancer Out Loud takes a closer look at the cancer experience using the power of storytelling. For those that are familiar with us, we are now bringing a fresh approach, embracing a new format that allows us to dive deeper into the world of cancer, one episode at a time. Instead of seasons, we're introducing numbered episodes, each offering a unique perspective, expert insights, and personal narratives that will educate, uplift, and empower. Whether you are a patient, survivor, caregiver, someone that lost a loved one, or someone hoping to find inspiration, Cancer Out Loud is your sanctuary, a place to find hope, understanding, and a sense of community. This podcast is produced by Cancer Care, the leading national nonprofit organization providing free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Welcome back to Cancer Out Loud, the Cancer Care Podcast. My name is Sarah Paul, and I'm the Director of Clinical Programs at Cancer Care. If you've been with us in the recent episodes, you've heard some stories that are really hard to wrap our minds around. Stories of loss that would almost be too heavy to bear without the presence of hope and understanding. So today, we continue our journey of grief exploration to speak with Nancy and Mike, two people who have navigated through the rocky path of grief and found each other, and some semblance of healing along the way. We are also joined by Kathy Nugent, our Senior Director of Regional Programs and the founder of Cancer Care's Healing Hearts Family Bereavement Camp. Mike, Nancy, and Kathy, thank you so much for joining me today. So to start off, I'd like to ask Nancy and Mike to share a little bit about Ed and Maria, the kind of people they were and what their journey was with cancer.
I was a music therapist. He used to work at a hospital helping people in a psychiatric unit, and he took his job very seriously. And he started feeling a little bit overwhelmed, but also feeling very tired, and he did not know the cause of it. He ended up at his clinic twice in a week, and the doctor said, "I don't like that. You are my healthiest patient here. And you've been here twice this week. I'm going to do some blood work on you." And a few days later, the results came with the diagnosis of acute myeloid leukemia. And we were both in shock because he was so healthy, a vegetarian, 41 years old. And it was hard for us to believe that he was having this harsh diagnosis. And he reached out to his family to see if there was anyone or any history, and there was none. And from his diagnosis in November 2018 until his passing in March 13, 2019 was 5 months.
So for Maria, Maria was a school teacher. She taught in New Jersey Public School District, kindergarten and first grade. Very full of life, healthy, athletic. She was actually breastfeeding our oldest daughter, Molly, while she was pregnant with our second daughter, Kiva. And she was having a lot of irritation and chafing on her nipple. She actually went to a few doctors, and everybody kind of gave the same diagnosis that because she was breastfeeding, it was a clogged milk gland. The medicine wasn't really healing it. So we came to find that after Kiva was born, she was losing weight, and the doctor saw was very concerned about the breast and the nipple, and had her go to see an oncologist. We thought it was a very unlikely scenario, and she was diagnosed with breast cancer. So she was able to treat it right away, dove headfirst into chemotherapy, eventually had a double mastectomy and reconstructive surgery. And, you know, we thought that we put it behind us. We had about a year or so of kind of normality. And then she started having back pains, which again, didn't really ring any alarm bells because she was an athlete and when she was younger and she had back pain throughout her life and her blood work was coming out okay. But unfortunately, it did turn out that the cancer had returned. And, you know, the second time around, she fought a brave fight, but ultimately the cancer took her.
Part of the story today is not only honoring Ed and Maria, but talking about how you both coped with not only their illnesses, but also their eventual death. And so when we're thinking about this, what were some of the challenges that you faced during their treatment phases? You know, especially with juggling work and household responsibilities, and you're both parents. What was that like?
For me, it was very overwhelming. I was working full time. Kaya and Ava, our two daughters, were 5 and 7, and we have Panchito, our Chihuahua, of now 16 and a half years old. Sometimes I feel that I was drowning. And I felt overwhelmed and also bad and guilty because Ed was in the hospital and he wanted to be home with us. And he was a father that never slept outside of the home since we were together for almost 10 years. So it was really overwhelming and it was really, I almost felt that I put the girls to sleep at 7:30, I was ready to be in bed at 8 because I was so tired physically and mentally. And I remember that at one point I ended up in the hospital. I fainted at work. And it was because of all the stress that I was carrying. But thank God I was able to recoup and go back to the girls and working and taking care of Pancho and also Ed in the hospital because I would go and see him every day. As soon as the girls went to their after-school program, I would go and see him and spend time with him. But it was very challenging because I was going to take family leave, but the doctor said to me, do not take your family leave yet. Wait until he comes home after the transplant. But obviously, he never, even though he had two donors, he never made it to the transplant stage because his health kept deteriorating and eventually, it was impossible.
Yeah, and very similar to what Nancy said, it was a whirlwind. I mean, it was my daughters at the time of her diagnosis. Molly had just turned 5 and Kiva was 2. So, you know, just trying to figure out kind of the daily routine of just getting the girls up, getting them dressed, brushing their teeth, getting them to school, and then taking care of Maria full time was quite a challenge. And Maria was somebody who was very independent, and really you could never do anything for her. And you know, when she became sick, one of the things that really was kind of a gift was she kind of put that aside and you know, allowed me to help her. So it was a lot, like Nancy said, with the kids. And I think it was one of these things where it felt like it was never ending. And you would sleep when you could, you eat when you could. And I just remember waking up and it just started all over again. So it was challenging, but I and appreciative and grateful to have been able to be that caregiver and really spend that time with Maria, you know, pretty much 24 hours a day when she was diagnosed the second time.
Both of you talk about these really unimaginable challenges that you hope you never find yourself in. And so what was it like to try to stay hopeful during this time? You both had a lot on your plate. It was extremely overwhelming. So where did the hope come from?
It was a belief that everything was going to go back to normal again. It was the hope and desire that it was going to come home again and that I was going to take care of him and that he was going to go into remission. And it was just the love and the hope. and he was going to come home. And I think that that was a driving force for me, that no matter how much I cried at night, how much I missed him, how tired I was so hopeful that he was going to come home. And I would say to him, I am going to meditate and I am going to send you healing energy at 10 o'clock at night. Because at that time, I knew that he was probably finished with a lot of the things that they do at the hospital. And then they get a little break. And I said, you know, and I used to say that I'm going to pray and I'm going to meditate on your health. So please tune in with my energy, I would say to him. And I would try doing that. Even when I was so tired, sometimes I would stay up just to be able to, at that time that I had said to him, kind of like connect through meditation and prayer.
I think Nancy and I both had this in common where maybe we were somewhat naive about the severity of the diagnoses. And but I am a very firm believer in, you know, it is important to stay positive. And I don't know what kind of scientific backing there is for it, but the fact that Maria was young, she was 35 years old when she passed, 34 when she was diagnosed for the second time. She was strong, she was healthy, and she was stubborn, and she had a strong will. I felt, even at looking kind of, which I don't know if it's good or bad, but looking at the statistics and seeing, wow, because she's on the healthier end of this, the younger end of this, she, you know, she has a better shot. And I did a lot of reading about, you know, new treatments and breakthrough treatments and experimental. And, you know, again, I think maybe some of these things were unrealistic, and I didn't realize that at the time. But, you know, I always did stay positive and, you know, always felt that this was just a hurdle. This was something that, you know, we were going to overcome, and maybe our lives would be different afterwards, and maybe she would be changed, you know, permanently, but that, you know, ultimately we were going to get through it.
Hope is a protective factor. Hope is something that pushes us forward. I want to ask, at what point did you feel that you understood that things were not going to get better? And how did you cope with that? Or was that not a moment that happened for either of you?
I saw that his health was deteriorating, but I remember a doctor saying to me, Nancy, you're so positive. I want you to plan, hope for the best, but plan for the worst. And when he said that, I said, you don't have the last word. God does. And I remember going to the bathroom and kneeling down and crying and saying, you know, praying to God to please restore Ed's health, that my daughters and I needed him, and that he was, you know, contributing so much at the hospital that he worked for. And I kept praying and praying and praying, even though, and then they were recommending hospice for him. I still did not want to accept that. I was not accepting it. And I remember going to the room and obviously coming out of the bathroom because someone knocked on the door. I cleaned my face and retouched my makeup and went to see him and pretended that the doctor did not have this conversation with me. I didn't want to accept that. I said, no, Ed is coming home. And no matter what, he's coming home, he's going to get better. You know, people die because they don't have a donor. He has two waiting for him. And I said to him, Ed, please. And I said, please just visualize yourself at night, visualize yourself healthy and coming home and, you know, with our daughters and I. And he said to me, he used to call me Amore. And he says, Amore, it's not my mind, it's my body giving up on me. And at that point, we both started crying. And it's like I felt hopeless, like I didn't know what else to do and he didn't know what else to do. And we just had to surrender. And surrendering was so hard for both of us because it was like we lost control of what we thought we had, but we really didn't. So I, you know, and even the day of his passing, I don't know that I was going to lose him. I don't know where I was. Like, I tell you, your mind plays tricks on you because he was so strong the whole time. And I know that he did not want the doctors to maybe share information with me that he was on morphine and that he was really in pain. And you know, so I was hopeful the whole time. And even when I lost him and I, you know, I was impacted by what I saw unexpectedly, which was I was able to see his soul leave the body. And at that moment, that's when I realized that he was leaving me.
Maria had, you know, two things that I think were kind of keeping her going outside of her daughters and her family. She loved being a teacher, and she really was looking forward to going back to school. And in fact, when she had the second diagnosis and she was having this back pain, she was going to school every day and coming home just wrecked and would just crash on the couch. And I kept telling her, Maria, you need to take some time off and we need to take a break. And she said, which always have a story, you know, no, the kids have a test tomorrow, or I want to do something. We have an assembly. One of my kids is reading. She really cared about teaching. We did find out with her back that actually one of the vertebrae in her spine had actually shattered from a tumor, and she was going to work with that, which the doctors were really just, you know, perplexed and they kind of had their minds blown by that. One of her dreams she had was, unfortunately, about a year before this diagnosis, again, both of her parents had passed, both from cancer unexpectedly and 6 days apart from each other. But they were very close to us because they were also our neighbors and they lived down the street from us. And one of the things that Maria kind of dreamt about was moving back to her childhood home. And what she would always kind of hang on to getting back to school and moving to the house she grew up in. And one day she said to me, I'm not going to go back to work. I want to retire. And I don't want to move to that house. I don't want to do that right now. So to me, that was kind of a big deal because these two things that she really cared a lot about, she was saying, let's not worry about those things right now. So she was able to have a disability retirement from teaching. And what really struck me was I had to complete some paperwork and have it filled out by her doctors. And I dropped the paperwork off. And then I remember picking it up a few days later. And one of the questions in the paperwork said, is there any chance of recovery? And the doctor wrote, no. And that just kind of was a very sobering moment. That kind of was like a slap in the face, like just hit me like a ton of bricks. And I think at that point, the reality had kind of kicked in. And at that point, it was maybe a week or two prior to her passing. So I think I remember asking the doctors, what about the Hail Mary? What's this one last treatment? What if I took her up to Boston for this experimental treatment? And the doctor said to me, Mike, we've done A, B, C, D, and E. You know, C, D, and E were the Hail Mary. So that was kind of sobering and you know, kind of made me realize the you know, I guess the inevitable point that we were in.
When your loved ones eventually did pass, what was coping? What did that even look like afterwards? You know, and I know that's a very broad question, but I ask it this way because people that are listening to these stories may have also lost someone. And we know that loss and grief look so different depending on who's experiencing it. So if you could talk a little bit about coping and if there were any, you know, rituals or anything that you did daily that helped manage those feelings. You know, there's no right or wrong answer here.
To me, it was my daughters and Pancho. I had to get up. I had to care for them. I had to, even if I wanted to stay home, even if I wanted to cry, even if I didn't want to get out of bed or eat, I had to do it for the girls. And they were the ones that actually helped me not really fall deep into a depression and move on. And I mean, move through, you know, not moving on, but moving through the grief for the girls. And then they had their own needs and they wanted to talk about daddy and they were missing daddy as well. And so just being there for them and talking to them and showing them pictures. And one of the things that I did that was hard at first, but then it became easier and easier, was not only being transparent with the girls, but talking about him, you know, wearing some of his things, looking at pictures, but also going to places that we used to go together when he was here. And the park, restaurants, we will be just going, the three of us. So instead of four, it was three. And I felt that we reconnected with his energy. Feel sad at first and that he wasn't there. But then the more we kept doing this, we started feeling grateful for the time that we got to go to these places with him and eating what he used to eat or something that he will order, we will order it. And we would think about Ed and we would say, I am so grateful that we had daddy, right? And that we came here with daddy. Or do you remember the last time we came here with daddy? And we will cry and we will smile and we will hug each other. But it was a way for us to heal. So that's one of the things that we did. We would go to the cemetery and we would spend time there and do the things or listen to the music that he used to listen. He was a jazz musician, but he also loved rock and roll. And so we will go back to listen to the music that he would play, and he left guitars around and the girls would pick the guitars and play guitars. And so that helped us. Also, I enrolled Nava and Kaya in an art therapy session where they can create art and I will be there with them and we will talk about the loss and we would connect with other children that also lost someone that they love. And so that was something that helped us coping with not having it around.
Yeah, very similar to what Nancy said. We had, you know, the girls kept me moving. And I'll never forget, you know, the day after Maria passed, I remember waking up and, you know, you felt like, you know, it was hard to get out of bed. And I had to. Because I had two young girls and they needed to eat, they needed to have their teeth brushed and their hair brushed and get dressed. So I think, you know, having my mind occupied with that was a positive thing. I will say, you know, I got very lucky in a sense because, you know, through a strange kind of set of coincidences, I was able to meet Ariana from Cancer Care. And but there was a last minute cancellation and Ariana kind of heard my story just from conversation and invited us to go to the Healing Hearts camp. And the Healing Hearts camp was really big for me, I have to say, because I'm very fortunate that I have a good support network and I have a large family and I'm blessed to have, you know, a lot of close friends. And, you know, you had people reaching out, you had people texting and calling and sending cards. And it was very nice and it was very appreciated. But at the same time, I was so overwhelmed by every daily thing that I had to do that, you know, just the simple thing of answering a text message added to my stress. So when I was able to go to the Healing Hearts camp, which I thought was really just for the kids, having the adult sessions and meeting all of these people who I couldn't believe their responses and their stories and their perspective. It was, you know, verbatim what I was thinking and what I was feeling. So then also meeting the Jalawickis was very important. I mean, very big moment in our lives because, you know, here are two young girls who met two other young girls who lost a spouse. And Nancy and I, you know, being married for about, you know, pretty much the exact same amount of time, and having stories with a lot of parallels and having somebody to be able to have these conversations with was very important. You know, we were able to take advantage of some of the services from Cancer Care as well. And my daughters went and saw Cecilia for counseling sessions. And I think a lot of those things really helped. I think especially for the girls, having somebody who could empathize with them was huge. My daughter Molly would not talk about this topic. And anytime I tried to bring it up, her response was, "I don't want to talk about it." And meeting Kaya Nava, who lost their father 2 months prior to Molly losing her mother, right away they opened up to each other, and I couldn't believe the conversations that they had.
For me, also, after Ed's passing, it was Ed's social worker that urged me to take the girls to Cancer Care Healing Hearts. And she was like, "Nancy, please apply. There is an application process. A lot of families apply. They only a certain amount of number of families get in. So please apply and take the girls. This will be so helpful for them." And like Mike, I thought that it was just for the girls. And obviously Kaya, who was 7, was having a really hard time with the loss of Ed, to the point that one night I hear her speaking in the room. And she says, "Daddy, I don't want to be here no more. Take me with you." And that really impacted me and really made me scared. And when I went in, I said, "Kaya, what are you saying?" She was like, "You're not supposed to hear me when I speak to Daddy." And so that, you know, with Kaya saying that, I really felt that I needed to get her extra help. And so Allison, it's social worker, kept, you know, following up with me, "Did you do it? Did you apply?" And I did. And what I found was, through the application process to apply for Healing Hearts was so healing for me. I was healing. I had to write a biography. And I remember that I was looking for a picture and I was writing the biography and the things that I wanted to say about him. And I couldn't, the first time I sat down to write it, I could not pass through the first paragraph. I was crying. I felt like a knot in my throat. And I had to stop. I couldn't continue. But then 2 days later, or a day later, I came back to it. Something similar happened until one day I came and I was able to finish it up without crying. And so I felt that I was healing, that the fact that I was completing this biography and gathering other artifacts to bring of it to celebrate him at Healing Hearts was actually healing and making me feel better. And at the end, I was looking forward to bringing the girls and planning for this event that really changed my life forever. And when I say changed my life forever, is because it took me 8 hours to get there due to a huge accident of 2 trucks, I believe it was. I was in traffic, you know, usually from New York City to where Healing Hearts were taking place was like 2.5 hours. I got there after midnight and I was the last family that got there. And I was blown away by the love and the support and the kindness and how much Kathy, Claire, and the staff, the volunteers of Cancer Care care. They had my lunch, 3 bags with 3 dinners for us because we didn't make it to the dinner. And so they, you know, our dinners were waiting for us. It was after midnight. And I felt bad. I was like, "Oh my God, they were here waiting for us. The last family they waited for." And that actually touched my heart in a grand way. And I knew that I had come to a place that was bigger than what I was going through. And the next day, obviously, Molly and the girls meet and they are talking with each other. And then I'm waiting for the girls to go and set up and they don't want to come. And they say, Mommy, we do not want to leave our new friend by herself because she loves her mommy and she misses her. And then when Mike comes, he introduces himself. And then I said to him what the girls had said to me. And he felt that this was really amazing that Molly was able to speak to Kaya Nava. But with all that said, there was another critical moment when we were divided to go into the support groups with our counselor. Mike spoke first, and when he and I didn't even know that there was going to be a support group for the adults. So Mike spoke first, and when he spoke, the bags of tissue were given to me because I had a crying attack. I really was crying. I could see myself in Maria's shoes, and I Mike was sharing what he was going through. And I'm like, well, and I'm here and I can do all these things so easily that he is having a hard time because, he's not used to coming here and to doing certain things with the bathings that I did so natural. But also hear him speak made me stop thinking things that I was thinking that were not so positive. And so after I heard him speak and sharing his experience with Maria twice and taking care of Maria for so long, I'm like, my God, he took care of Maria for over 3 years. I dealt with this for 5 months. And, I started being grateful and finding all the things that I can be grateful for. And I started being grateful for my life, for Ed, for my family, for being at Cancer Care, for having this opportunity to really talk about what I've been through and have others listening to what I have to say and vice versa. And so this is, I always say that the fact that I was able to go to Cancer Care not only changed my life and the things that I was thinking about, but also that I was able to meet Mike and his family.
For those that are listening, if you haven't been able to gather this, Mike and Nancy met at Cancer Care's Healing Hearts Family Bereavement Camp. And so I want to push this over to Kathy, who's here with us, to talk more about Cancer Care's Healing Hearts Camp and how it started and what it does for families. So Kathy, please tell us a little bit more.
First of all, thank you, Nancy and Mike. Your story touches my heart. It really makes me appreciate the Healing Hearts. It's kind of one of my babies that I love being able to work at it and host this every year. I think Cancer Care kind of soar many years ago. This year will be 15 years. Back in 2009, we started the camp. We saw a need to have a place, a special place, for families who are grieving the loss of their loved one to cancer to come together to share their grief, their memories with each other. So the first camp was held in 2009 at Camp Greeley in Pennsylvania, which was a camp for boys and girls. I have to say the accommodations were rough. I remember sleeping on cots, and it was just very, very different from what we have now. But it was always wonderful outdoor activities for the families to enjoy, especially the children. And I can't emphasize more the need for kids to be together, to talk about their grief, but also to feel not alone. And our first camp we did have, it's interesting, was a lot more activities. We had rock climbing and fishing and archery and swimming, as well as therapeutic events. But the focus and the goal of the camp has always been to provide a safe place for our grieving families with children, a place to share their feelings and connect with others who've experienced similar loss to cancer. Following Camp Greeley, we did go for many, many years to the Malibu Dude Ranch in Pennsylvania. And the last 3 years, we've been at Memory Town USA in Mount Pocono, where we will be again next June. By offering this free camp weekend, our families come together and meet others who are grieving a similar loss. And I think that's the piece that really drives this camp. Not only do we offer fun activities, but we also do grief activities. And these activities really focus around memories. We want our families to feel comfortable talking about their loved ones, sharing their memories. Families come together. We usually start in the mornings on Saturday morning doing a craft, such as a memory collage or memory jars. And each year we do have a theme, which is carried throughout the whole weekend. It was mentioned earlier, I think, by Nancy, that we have a support group. We do have support groups for the adults, and we break those into, fathers, mothers, grandparents. One thing I do want to mention, this camp is really open to any family member who has, the loss could be a parent, it could be the loss of a spouse, it could be the loss of a child. So it really is a camp that we embrace all family loss. The adults meet throughout the weekend in their support groups, as well as the children. We break the children up in the morning into age-appropriate groups. We'll have ages 4 through 17. The little ones will meet from age 4 to 10, and then we have the tweens and the teens. And these groups, again, they talk about their memories. The little ones are learn a dance that they'll perform at the memorial service, and the teens write a song in memory of their loved ones. And then the afternoons are free. They have a lot of fun activities. We have horseback riding and fishing and outdoor games and sports. In the evening, we have our memorial service, and this is a special time where the children, the little ones, will perform their dance and the teens will do the song that they've written. But also it's a time where each loved one, their name is shared. And we have moments of silence, really, to remember the loved one who has passed. It's really a beautiful memorial service. And Sunday, the last day of the camp, we usually, again, break the kids into groups. But the adults, and this is really one of the more powerful moments of the weekend, is we have what we call our resilience panel. And this consists of adults and young adults also who share their stories of resilience and hope. And this can be a really very powerful for parents who are listening, who are struggling in how to manage their own grief while at the same time supporting their children who are feeling this loss. So it really gives them a sense of hope and resilience by listening to these stories of these adults and young adults who have, many of whom have come to the Healing Hearts camp in the past. They're sharing their stories of their struggles, but also their resilience and how they've been able to carry on in their lives and support their children. But one thing I do want to mention about the Healing Hearts camp is that it is unique in that this camp is for the whole family. There are camps out there for children who are grieving, but this particular, I think the uniqueness about our camp is that the whole family can come and really there, you know, kids, and I think Nancy, you may have mentioned this, that, you know, sometimes kids feel so alone with their loss. They don't know other kids who have gone through a loss of a parent. So this camp gives the children an opportunity to not feel so alone or so different because they're making friends, they're meeting other kids. So I think that's an important piece that really came out with your discussion and sharing, Nancy and Mike, but I did want to emphasize that about the camp and how that piece of it is so unique. Thank you both.
So thank you so much, Kathy, for sharing about that. And for those listening, please reach out if you have questions or if you want to attend. And so, you know, going back to Mike and Nancy, how important was the Healing Hearts Camp, not only in your own journey of grief, but in forming connections with others who have had similar situations?
To me, it was, it changed the course of my life. And the fact that there were others there who had gone through worse things than I did, kind of like makes you realize that, you know, you're not alone and that there are people who are going through so much and you think you are going through a lot. And, you know, I was thinking I was, you know, swimming in grief. You meet all these families and all of them have a story to tell that is similar yet different from yours. And what do we have in common? We lost a loved one and we are grieving, but we are here and we are saying yes to life and we are celebrating them. And the fact that we are celebrating them is what motivates us to be and to accept and to let the pain transform us and what we are going through. And accepting that, you know, that this happened. But yeah, I am so grateful to be here in this moment. And in this moment, I am okay. And that's what I felt at Cancer Care. And I left Cancer Care that Sunday so light. Like I have left and healed tremendously in just those 3 days. I remember the horseback riding that we did and how I was connected with nature and I became very mindful of the smells, the leaves. I'm like, oh my God, these leaves are so beautiful. And one is so different from the other, but yeah, there's so many leaves here. And that's how I felt, that we were like those leaves that had gone through so much and we were different, but at the same time, we were leaves, we were grieving. And just being in nature was very powerful, not only to me, but also to the girls. Till this day, they talk about these, all of the activities. They love it because they are so engaged and the time is allocated for them to do that. So it's very powerful. So it really changed our lives.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Initially, when I was given the opportunity for it, I thought, well, anything I can take advantage of to help my kids, I'm going to jump at. And it was offered for Molly at the time. Kiva was too young to attend. She was 3. The impact that it had on me, you know, I never in my life, and, you know, it's good advice I've had from people, what did I do for myself as far as self-help? And did I speak to anybody? Did I speak to a therapist? And I think that's good advice. And I think it's something that I should have done. And I think, again, being overwhelmed with just work and the kids and the house, the idea of trying to even schedule something. And then how do I get there? And who's going to watch the kids? And do I have to call the insurance company and figure out, is this covered? I didn't want to put anything else on my plate. But having those conversations with the other families and the other adults, especially at Cancer Care, it just felt really positive and good and felt a strong connection to everybody there. And then obviously, Nancy and I, we realized how the girls were helping each other through this. And we began spending a lot of time together following Healing Hearts. And we really became a family very quickly. And I think it was this bonding over the tragedy that we had in common that really brought us together. So absolutely, it was a very, very significant event in our lives.
There is so much tragedy in these stories, but also we see the hope, we see the growth, we see the love still. And so thinking about, you know, you joined your families together. And so how do you continue to maintain the memory of Ed and Maria in this new life that you've created together?
One of the things that I did, because I feel that I had a story to tell, was that I wrote a book, Grief and Gratitude, Embrace Your Soul's Journey to Joy, Love, and Abundance After Loss. And in this book, I go into detail about my experience with Cancer Care, but also my experience with grief. And for me, not only once, but twice, because I I lost my first baby boy at 9 months. And so Ed and I went through that. And then a few years later, I lose Ed. I had to share and help others go through their grief, because I feel that every adversity that we go through in life comes with that transformation that makes us, like Kathy said, more resilient and more grateful. And so one of the things that I did was, besides writing the book, was that I started writing poems to Ed. So I have written a few poems for him. We also go to the cemetery every March 13, or around that time, we have a mass for him. And we, after that, we go celebrate at a restaurant where families and friends are gathered, and we share memories about who he was. And we cry and we laugh and we heal and we feel so much better. Also, we celebrate November 1st, 2nd, the Day of the Dead. And so at that day, we talk about them, we see pictures, and we would eat Ed's favorite meal. And Maria, she used to love chocolate, so we will have chocolates around. When we move into our home, we created a memorial for them where our girls will see Mike and Maria, Molly and Kiva, and Ed and I, Kaya and Ava. And so these are the pictures that were put up first in our house, along with some plants. We see them every day when we pass, because every day we have to pass through that space multiple times, because it's the way to go to our kitchen. So the girls know that it is safe, that we want to celebrate them, and that there is no us without them.
Yeah, I mean, these are the things that I think are very valuable. We have our rituals over the course of the year, you know, celebrating the anniversaries. And that's really a highlight for me as well, because we get friends and family together. And, you know, we like Nancy said, we laugh and we cry and we tell stories. And it's cool because it's a day that is really all about them. And, you know, it brings them back for that time, for sure. Every night we do say a prayer with the girls, and we always close the prayer with, "Dear God, please watch over Maria and Ed, and Maria and Ed, please watch over us." And we try to make that part of our ritual, because we want them mentioned daily. We want them part of the conversation daily. We never shy away from, "Hey, you know, this reminds me of the time Ed did this," or, you know, "Maria really liked to eat this type of food." We always want to bring that up. We always want to make them part of the family, and we consider them part of the family. The little memorial that Nancy spoke about, you know, I think it's perfect because it's very subtle and it's in a prominent place in the house. And it really is, it's kind of a picture of our families before Maria and Ed passed, and then our family now, you know, united. Two families united as one. And, you know, Nancy really gave me some good advice, because after Maria passed, I set up almost kind of a shrine to her. And it was almost like a whole room and a wall covered in photos and one giant tapestry with a picture of her and the family. And, you know, Nancy very kind of subtly put it to me that, you know, maybe this is something that's a little too much and a little overwhelming. And I think toning that down and having our really just kind of beautiful, subtle memorial that's part of our daily experience is a much more healthy approach.
You know, I love the things that you both described, and, you know, this, the idea that, you know, Maria and Ed, they're in your lives every day, and they're part of your lives every day. And that's such a beautiful thing that you guys have created. I'm wondering, how did the girls react to the blending of your families, and how has it been for them to lean on one another as time has gone on?
Well, you know, that's actually the funny thing, because, you know, both Nancy and I, we met very shortly after our loved ones passed. And I think both of us, you know, really had this idea that an acceptance and totally okay with it, that we were going to be single parents. I think we were both feeling like single parents for some time, because even with Maria and Ed alive, you know, when they were in the state that they were in, we were really single parents. And obviously we didn't go to Healing Hearts looking for romance or anything along those lines. It really was because the girls hit it off together and we started spending that time together that we kind of grew together as a family. The girls were really the ones that encouraged, I think, before they had an understanding of, I guess, the relationship that had kind of developed between Nancy and myself. They were the ones who were almost trying to play matchmaker and would, you know, hand Nancy a flower when I wasn't there and say, oh, this was from Mike. Mr. Mike wanted to give this to you. So the girls really, you know, it's an interesting dynamic, because the fact that they kind of met and they kind of bonded over this, and they have this strong bond. And I think they started as friends first before they became sisters. They're really close. And, you know, we're blessed because even Nancy and I say all the time, we both came from large families and we had a lot of siblings and we were always fighting with our siblings. And these girls really get along very well and rarely have disagreements and always have each other's backs and always stick with each other. The big joke was we initially lived together. We lived in a small house that was the house I had purchased with Maria. And it was a tiny house, and the girls all shared a room. And, you know, we had two beds and then we had two mattresses on the floor, and you could barely walk in the room. You had to kind of tiptoe around the mattresses. And we had this idea during COVID, and we got a little bit of cabin fever and we're looking for space. And we bought a bigger house, twice the size, more than twice the size of the house that we had. And everybody had the opportunity to have their own rooms. And here we are, we're in the house over 3 years, and they're still choosing to sleep together every night, and they still sleep in the same bedroom. And I love that. And Nancy loves that also. And it's something we don't want to, you know, if that changes, we want that to happen kind of organically when they're ready to move apart or have their own space. But right now they really love spending that time with each other. One of the biggest compliments I think we received from multiple people, they see the girls at school, they see the girls at church, and they say, you know, each one of them always is kind of looking out for the other and always has each other's back. So I kind of attribute that to that strong bond that really started when they met at Healing Hearts.
It's so sweet to hear that they, even though they didn't really understand or realize what was going on, that they were trying to play matchmaker and that their heart was in the right place, obviously. But I also love to hear their bond that continued to develop and can develop throughout time. So before we wrap up the episode, I did want to ask, you know, if any advice or message for someone who might be listening, who's recently lost a loved one to cancer or their spouse to cancer, and they also have young children, what's something that you would share with them?
Be positive and fight. Be there, be present. Be present, be mindful, and do as much as you can to celebrate your loved ones. If they're in the hospital or if they pass, still find ways to celebrate them. And if you need to cry, if you need to scream into your pillow, if you need to go away for a few days to reconnect with yourself and reorient, or maybe figure, what am I going to do now? Do that. Take time for yourself, which is something that we don't usually do, but it's very important. Go out. Walk, take walks. I used to do that when I was feeling very overwhelmed. I would take walks and go to the park. And just the fact that I would put my sneakers on and go out for a walk and hear the birds singing and being in touch with nature and hear children laughing at the playground, that really distracted me from my what was going on in my mind and my thoughts. So I would say go out even if you don't want to, and being grateful for the time that you had your loved ones in your life and how because of them you are a better person. So that's what I would say. I would say, Ed, thank you so much. Because of you, I'm a better person.
I think for me, it's, you know, it's cliche to say, but time does improve things and it does get easier over time. I think one of the things that, you know, I kind of learned from Nancy and still need to get better at is I think both of us we're kind of those type A personalities, and we're always going, we're always moving. And, you know, what Nancy kind of said to me is it's okay not to sign up for everything. It's okay to not, you know, go to every event if you can't make it or you're stretched too thin. I know, you know, just today I received a couple emails from the school speaking about, you know, some of these activities after school. And I think that parental guilt comes in that you want to take advantage of every opportunity for your kids, and you want to sign them up for everything, and you want them to go to everything. And, you know, there's a reality to it. And there's, you know, there's only so much that you can do. You know, we have to prioritize our activities. So I think that's an important part too. We have this pressure as parents of trying to do as much as we can for our kids, but, you know, maybe taking a step back and accepting what is possible, and what, you know, really is going to make your life better, and what's going to add stress to your life, and making your decisions and prioritizing based on that. For those out there, I mean, the one last piece of advice that I can give is, it's important to understand that people mean well, and people are going to offer advice, and people are going to have opinions on things. And the bottom line is, you know, you're in a situation now where your life has changed and your family dynamic has changed. And I would say always think about when you're making decisions, what do you need to do for your family, and what do you need to do for your children and yourself, and put that ahead of, you know, the interest or the opinions of other people who, you know, are going to have opinions on things. You need to do what's right for you and what you think is right for your kids.
Well, thank you all for joining me today. This was a really rich discussion. And, you know, Mike and Nancy, thank you again for sharing your story, for letting us in. And Kathy, thank you for being here and talking about the Healing Hearts Camp and all the wonderful work that you do.
Thank you so much, Sarah. And thank you so much, Kathy. And we appreciate being a part of this. And I hope that this can be, you know, if there's anything that resonates with people, we're very happy to have shared.
Thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to share our story with you and your audience. And thank you, Healing Hearts Cancer Care, for their amazing work that you do, helping so many families like us heal and be supported and be loved. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Cancer Out Loud, the Cancer Care Podcast. Cancer Care is the leading national nonprofit organization providing free professional support services, including resource navigation, cancer-focused counseling, support groups, educational resources, and financial assistance to anyone affected by cancer. You can visit us online at cancercare.org or call our toll-free hope line at 800-813-HOPE. That's 800-813-4673 to speak with a master's prepared oncology social worker.